Welcome to the Foolish Racing Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:31 PM. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with the dollar index because it's probably one of the most important factors that's going to affect asset classes over the coming years. When we think about its trend and its cyclicality over the course of the last 50 years, then we can see that there are major bull and bear themes and that each of the bull markets tends to have reasonably similar lengths of big moves. We had a peak, for example, in 69 and a low in 78. So that was one of the longer bear markets. It was all the way down for about 9 years. From the low in 78, it got all the way up to a peak in 85, so that was the 7 years exactly. By the time that it really started to retest the low in 95, then the next big peak was in 2001, so it was about 6 years, but the low from 92 up to 2001 was 9 years as well. Then when we look at the next low in 2008, the low after that was 2016, so it was 8 years. From 2011 through to 2016-17 was about 6 or 7 years, depending on how one wants to look at it. We can also see that in between the periods of major bull markets, there were lengthy bottoming phases. Now, when we can think about the peaking phases, well, they were mostly really quite sharp reversals. We did have a reversal, for example, in between most of 2017 through to the middle of 2018, and then a rebound. And overall, this has been a lengthy period of ranging. But now, as we think about, well, what happened in these periods when the dollar did peak? Well, one important peak was in 1970. Now, that was quite different from every other peak because it went on for a while, but of course it coincided with coming off the gold standard, so the dollar trended lower for the next decade. Then we had a very significant rebound in the early 1980s, and it required multilateral intervention to try and start bringing down the dollar. And it succeeded. Multilateral intervention always works because it means that central banks around the world, they just coordinate their efforts to control supply and demand. So then multilateral intervention is a reliable indicator of what's likely to happen. Well, then we can think about the period in 2001 and 2 and 3. Well, we have to remember that the dollar had been rallying. It was the strongest currency in the world all the way up to the peaks in 1999. With the technology bull market that had been going on then, it acted as this incredible magnet for investment, where investors all over the world were investing in new technologies that were going to change the world beyond recognition. And they could do it in an appreciating currency. And the USA had just moved into a period where the government was running surpluses, and that's a very rare condition for the USA, particularly as the host for the reserve currency. But then we had the crash in 1999, well, really in 2000-2001, and then there was the 9/11 attacks as well. And the determination subsequently by the Federal Reserve to ensure there was ample liquidity and to keep interest rates low for a prolonged period of time was the big fear back then was financial repression. When I first started working with David in the late autumn of 2003, financial repression was one of the things that people were really getting fearful about. And now we're starting to see a rerun of exactly the same kinds of fears because the Federal Reserve today is talking about keeping interest rates low for a prolonged period, meaning maintaining ample liquidity for as long as it takes for inflationary pressures to begin to rise again. And therefore not, and in fact, they've changed the way that they think about things. They're no longer willing to predict markets, but in fact, they're waiting for average levels to maintain strength beyond their target ranges. What that in fact suggests is that they are no longer willing to predict, but rather wait for evidence. And even when they have evidence, they're not going to do anything until the evidence is proved to be beyond transitory. Now, if we start to think about, well, what does that mean? It means that they're going to do whatever it takes to create an inflationary bias. And that's obviously something that everybody is questioning. But if we think then about the dollar index, when that type of policy was introduced back in 2002, it resulted in a very significant bear market for the dollar. Of course, we also have to remind ourselves that it coincided with the introduction of the euro, and after a period of initial weakness, there was again intervention to support the euro, and it then took off. So there was a willingness in Europe to allow the currency to appreciate in order to demonstrate the success of the euro project. And that was the other side of the trade when we start to think about, well, if the dollar was weakening, what other region was willing to allow its currency to appreciate in order to pick up the slack? Of course, today, no major country wants a strong currency. So if we're thinking about a bear market in the dollar and the clear potential that we could be in for a period of underperformance, which could last for years, that this period of underperformance, and certainly very akin to the kinds of scenarios that we had in the 1970s, where we had this fearful environment among policymakers. They had been through a period, just thinking about if you were sitting in the Congress or Senate in the USA in the early 1970s, where there was this incredibly unpopular war in Vietnam. A number of high-profile civil rights figures had been assassinated. The president of the USA had been assassinated, and there was incredible civil unrest and demands for social justice. Well, they were obviously panicking, and then they embarked upon this massive financial, or I guess it was in conjunction with the Federal Reserve. What they did was they went through a period of debt financing. So the Federal Reserve printed as much money as was required by the government. They ran significant deficits. They devalued the currency. And in so doing, it created inflationary bias because the Gulf nations saw that the value of the dollar that they were accepting in return for their oil exports was being devalued in real time. So they demanded more of them, and that led to the oil crisis. Well, now we can think about where are we today. The capital has just been invaded, and you have a large number of elderly gentlemen who were fearful for their lives less than 10 days ago. And were it not for the heroic actions of a small number of people, then people that were trying to gain access to the Senate could have done bodily harm to a large number of the most elderly statesmen in the USA. When people are fearful for their lives, well then, what is it likely that they're going to do? The most likely scenario is that they are going to try and appease the unrest. So we've had examples now of violent protest from both left-wing, right-wing, and anarchistic at people within the USA in the space of less than a year. We've also seen that there have been mass protests at lockdowns, mass protests at social injustice, and at whole areas of cities taken over by anarchists. Well, this is obviously extremely distressing from the perspective of people who are looking out for the best interests of the country, and they're likely to engage in a great deal of spending. So with the Biden administration coming into power, they've automatically, the first thing that they've tried to do, or that they're proposing to do, is to increase the minimum wage to $15. $15 times 40 is 600. So anyone working a 40-hour week would be making $31,000 a year. That is roughly equivalent to the additional payments that people were earning from unemployment benefits during the summer when they had been kicked out of their jobs. So the big question that I'd had back then was, what on earth are people going to do when they were making more money from being unemployed than working? So are they just going to go back to work and accept lower wages, or are they going to demand higher wages? Well, what we're now seeing is that the government is stepping in and saying, well, you're definitely going to have higher wages if you take a job. Now the big question after that will be, are they going to reduce unemployment benefits to encourage people to go and look for jobs? But of course, this is also going to throw the onus for paying wages onto the private sector. And it's going to be the companies that have got the biggest margins are going to be best able to accommodate these much higher wages. It's not quite the same for a city like New York or Los Angeles to or San Francisco to introduce a $15 minimum wage, because minimum wages there have been higher for already for quite a while. And even then, it's been approximately 4 years where wages have been incrementally rising on an annual basis to reach the $15 an hour. When we think about other states in the USA where the minimum wage is probably more like $7, then a doubling of the minimum wage is a profound change for a lot of lower income workers. But most particularly, what about the people that were earning $10? Or that were earning $12. That was probably double or close to double what the minimum wage was before. And now entry-level people will be earning what they were earning. So it's going to result in two things. One will be a push factor in terms of demands for higher wages. And then, of course, there is the pull factor, which is that businesses are going to simply introduce additional technology, or they're going to go bust. A lot of companies will simply decide not to reopen. Others will deploy technology to ensure that they have the fewest possible workers. And it is this interplay between supply and demand which is the foundation of the economy. Well, as we think about what all of this means, it's going to further create a gap between the people that are most well equipped in terms of knowledge and skills to prosper in a technologically advanced society and those that aren't. And increasing minimum wages isn't going to change that. In fact, it could potentially exacerbate the problem without a massive program of training. And adult training is practically impossible without wages to compensate people for the time required to take on that training. When we then think about where we are in the dollar's trend, well, it's long-term likely to fall, medium-term also likely to fall, but in the short term, we could quite easily see a rebound. And I was looking at various time frames before I started recording, but we can see that the dollar index is right in the region of the lows from back in 2018. It's the lower side of a six-year range, so it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we might have some additional firming, although the price did pull back modestly into the end of this week. I still think, though, that with stock markets where they are, we're likely to see at least some pause in consolidation before very long, particularly in the most overextended of instruments. But if the dollar continues to break, if the dollar breaks down, then it's going to add additional fuel to some of these very exaggerated trends. The reality is if we think about the other periods of weakness in the dollar, particularly the period from about 2003 to 2008, it didn't stop stock markets from rallying. It's simply that they were rallying in nominal terms, and that other markets did much better. So it's worth considering that when instead, and there's a general practice to look at markets from a US dollar perspective. And it certainly helps if you type in the tickers correctly. Now, if we think about the significant rebound we've had in the dollar, or excuse me, in the S&P 500, that has been really quite impressive in nominal terms. When we look at it in euro terms, however, it is only just on the cusp of breaking out, and it's arguable whether it's going to hold this breakout in the short term. From the perspective of a pound investor, it has been doing better. The Australian dollar has been quite a bit stronger than the euro over the balance of 2020 from the March low, so it has not broken on the upside. But then if we think about it the other way around, now let's look at European indices and think about Europe in from the perspective of a US dollar investor. Well, the Eurostoxx index is on the cusp now of breaking out to new recovery highs from the perspective of a dollar investor. From a euro investor's perspective, it's right at the upper side of what is effectively a 20-year range. So we can then think about the period up from the lows in 2003 to the peak in 2008. That was a period where the euro was strengthening, and the market went from 150 to 450, so a 200% advance. Well, that was during a period of euro strength and dollar weakness. So we can think about the fact that the performance we've seen on Wall Street over the course of the last few years has been predicated on a strong dollar and outsized earnings, and the strength of the technology sector, and the kinds of value propositions that represents, particularly in a low interest rate environment. What we're now moving more towards is a phenomenon more akin to what we saw in the early 2000s, where it's the dollar decline is seeing an appreciation in nominal terms for Wall Street. There will be isolated cases where we're going to see outsized moves, and certainly I'll spend the second half of this broadcast talking about where the themes that are emerging are likely to be. But the most important point is that if we're in a new dollar bearish environment, well, it's going to be bullish for some currencies. There might not be anybody who wants a particularly strong currency, but the one that has appreciated most over the balance of 2020 has been the renminbi. It has clearly broken its downtrend, and obviously we have a very short-term oversold condition for the dollar. There is the potential that we are heading towards a period of renminbi weakness, just simply because it has moved so much already. But the trend could quite easily be towards greater renminbi strength. Then when we think about the Japanese yen, well, the yen has been trending higher against the dollar for most of, I should put that in the other way around. When we think about it, just looking at the yen appreciating, it's clearly got base formation characteristics. We had the clear downtrend from the peaks in 2011. That was the primary period of Abenomics. We've had the rebound for the dollar in 2016, for the yen in 2016, and now we've had this very lengthy period of right-hand extension. There's been a very consistent sequence of higher reaction lows overall. Now, obviously, the Japanese are defending the 10 level, and again, that is the 100 level, 100 yen to the dollar. But the trend suggests that the yen will appreciate. So that's, I think, one of the other potential beneficiaries of the dollar depreciation. And when we think about that in terms of the stock market, well, the Nikkei has completed a first step above the long-term base, and it has clearly broken out over the course of the last 3 months. So yes, there is a short-term overbought condition, but the other big point, of course, is that it has been ranging for an incredibly prolonged period of time. And when we look at it in US dollar terms, well, it does help to highlight that in US dollar terms, it's not just breaking out of a base, but it's actually breaking out to new all-time highs. So the depreciation of the dollar over this, what is effectively a 30-year period, is now flattering the performance of the Nikkei overall. And of course, when we then think about it in topics terms, then we're also seeing a similar phenomenon. So the topics, of course, is the much wider index. So it has clearly now completed this extraordinarily long ranging phase overall. Now, as we then look at that in local currency terms, well, I really do need to get a longer term chart. Well, we can see that the strength of the yen over the course of this 30-year period has acted as a headwind for the topics. So we have it in dollar terms just about breaking out, but in yen terms, it hasn't quite yet broken out of this base formation, even though we have this very incremental sequence of higher highs. It's going to have to sustain a move above the 2000 level in order to truly confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. As we think about, well, what is likely, therefore, it's quite, I think, apparent at this stage that some of the clearest trends that are breaking out of very, very long-term ranges are in Asia. So we've definitely seen that in Taiwan, in South Korea, in the Emerging Markets Index, which is very dominated by the Chinese markets. We're, of course, in a period of time where the Indian market is also starting to attract a lot of interest. Now, the Nifty has been rallying really very impressively off the lows in March, and it's pausing now over the last few weeks. And the size of the reactions, particularly the last three, are relatively similar sized. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility that it pulled back by 1,000 points and still be in an overall bull market. But one thing that India has going for it is that the rest of the world sees it as a counterweight to China. So India is probably going to have an easier time of having technology transferred to it, having greater assistance in terms of access to credit from the rest of the world, in order to build it up as a counterweight to China in the Asian region. That's certainly the policy of the USA. So that's, I think, a really quite important development. And of course, India has been shackled in many respects by the sclerotic, bureaucratic environment. But when we then think about the rupee, well, it's been in a secular bear market. In fact, it has done practically nothing but decline since 1980, although there have been periods where it just went sideways. And we're probably starting one of those now. Despite the fact that India is running an historic deficit, the rupee is appreciating. And there is the clear scope that in a world that is bereft of growth opportunities, well, India has got the tailwinds of incredibly favorable demographics. And then we also have the incredible phenomenon of growth from an incredibly low base. So with very young people and with a less developed economy and the application of technology and the fact that they can jump in terms of whole steps in their development and will have less of a difficult time expanding exports internationally, then that's a recipe for India to continue to outperform. That demographic change, I think, is one of the biggest things that people worry about. When we think about, you know, what the growth potential is in the rest of the world relative to the countries with favorable demographics, it's the primary argument that's used to argue that we're not going to have a big inflationary outcome from the rest of the world. This chart from Bianco Research a couple of years ago is something that's been sort of come at the back of my mind for a long time, because we can see that if we look at the median age of countries and where their bond yields are, well, what it suggests is that if one were to start buying the bonds of places like India or Mexico or Indonesia or Turkey, then they should do better. Now, that, of course, should be measured against what the governance situation is like in those countries. And that would probably immediately excise places like Turkey from the list. Obviously, South Africa has higher yields and less favorable governance. India, it would probably be what might be considered the sweet spot. So when we then think about what are Indian government bonds doing, well, nobody is really considering the potential that the rupee might in fact stabilize. But Indian government bond yields have been steady now around 6% for a while, and they were 9% a few years ago. So if we think about where we are in terms of development, there's the potential that India's government bonds may not be the kinds of risky investments that they have been historically. The stock market might have some segments of overvaluation, but it's from a high growth environment overall. Whereas what we have in Wall Street is very high valuations, and then this question about what's going to happen with the bond market, because deficits are extraordinarily high. They went into the current recessionary environment with extraordinarily high deficits and tax cuts in a mature phase of an expansion. They're coming out of this recession with even bigger deficits. So, and a rest of population with absolutely no patience for the kinds of fiscal constraint that would be required to try and balance the books. So they don't have much choice. They have to devalue the currency in the USA. And that is going to result in a significant exodus of resources from the US over the coming years. Now, obviously, we still have a significant bull market in technology, and the NASDAQ broke out to new all-time highs in the last week. It's being led higher by some of the mega caps. Google, in particular, has been rallying. Now, I am rather favorably disposed to Google for the simple reason that they have been plowing money into R&D. And they have leading positions in quantum computing and autonomous vehicles. Rather than buying back shares, rather than paying a dividend, the company has actually been investing in research and development. So even if neither of those big speculative bets come off, well, they're still plowing money into research and development. Then if we think about Apple, well, they haven't produced a new hit product since the iPhone. Certainly, they've been doing very well with accessories for the iPhone. And they do well from the ecosystem developed by the iPhone. Well, Apple is now talking about autonomous vehicles. And they are looking at potentially hooking up with Hyundai to produce an Apple car. Of course, that Apple car will not be in the market until about 2025, and that is assuming they do in fact go ahead with it. But the one thing that we certainly know is that when interest rates are this low, when countries like Japan, Europe, and Australia have already adopted a yield curve control, then the potential is that the USA will also adopt yield curve control. They'll hold down yields. Money will still be freely available. What it in fact means is that negative real interest rates basically defraud savers. It forces savers and investors to speculate. So that's why we continue to see these explosive moves. The one thing that has characterized 2021 so far has been the prevalence of these explosive moves on the upside. There has been almost universal approval for any automotive company that has completely given up on the internal combustion engine. So at the CES conference at the turn of the year, GM said they were going to bring out over 20 new models for electric vehicles next year. And the share has rebounded in very emphatic fashion. And it's broken out of what is effectively a decade-long range. So Tesla is definitely going to have more competition. In fact, at the Westfield Mall around the corner from where I live, Tesla's got a reasonably large boutique, and one of the other, I'm not going to get the name correct, I think it's Lumentum or something to that effect, is after setting up their own boutique literally across the square from Tesla. So they certainly have more competition. But Tesla has been a lightning rod for speculation. So when we think about the incredible performance of sectors to date, and we think about, well, what are the potential beneficiaries of this environment where we have a weak dollar, the clear potential that we're going to be in a negative interest rate environment, a negative real interest rate environment for the foreseeable future, and that is likely to result in significant demand for financial assets, at least until inflationary pressures force interest rates to begin to rise. We saw today, or this week, for example, that the Bank of Canada has said that they are thinking about what tapering might look like. They certainly haven't begun it, but they have said that in the event that the economy does better, they will taper their assistance. We've also seen today that Christine Lagarde has said that the ECB may not yet or may not deploy all of the resources that were made available to it in order to support the economy. And that is despite the fact that Europe is moving back into recession as the pace of vaccinations has been slower than in others, in other places. So as we think about where are we, well, interest rates are unlikely to rise for the foreseeable future. And by that I mean they probably won't rise for at least a year and probably maybe two. And in the intervening period, then with the clear need to support the real economy, then the financial economy can continue to do well. That doesn't mean that Tesla can't pull back in a violent manner. It could have, and it would still be above the 200-day moving average. Eventually, we're definitely going to see more competition coming into the electric vehicle market, and that is likely to be a primary benefit for copper. So copper is now in all likelihood in a secular bull market. When we think about the fact that it's been ranging now for approximately 14 years, then we can think that copper was often regarded as Dr. Copper because it was instrumental in economic growth, whether that was in infrastructure or communications infrastructure. But what we're now seeing is that there are whole new use cases emerging for copper in the transportation sector because electric batteries require a great deal of it. Then we can also think about the fact that it's going to be much more required in electricity generation, which is a whole new use case. So that's an additional upward or a demand-dominated environment, and it's against a background of a supply inelasticity because it takes years to develop new copper mines, and we just haven't had the same kind of investment in industrial resources since the crash after the peak in 2011. Then nickel is also a significant beneficiary from the march of the electric vehicle, and prices have held an upward bias now for the last 5 years, but haven't really gone very well, gone very far. So there's clear potential that nickel will also do better from here, and not least because the demand for nickel sulfide for batteries requires much higher quality and purity for nickel than for other resources, and that's more expensive to produce, so it will require additional demand. If we think about idiosyncrasies, well, companies like Sherritt International pretty much almost went bust, particularly when Donald Trump introduced sanctions against Cuba. Well, with the Biden administration, then they certainly have potential to do better. If we're thinking about commodities doing better, then there is clear scope for the commodity-related currencies to also trend higher. So the Australian dollar, it went all the way down and exceeded the lows from 2008, and it remains on a recovery trajectory. The Canadian dollar has also been particularly weak in the early part of 2020, but it has rebounded and broken its downtrend overall. Even when we think about countries like Russia, well, the ruble got back to test the lows from the last 5 years, and it has steadied from the 80 level. The Brazilian real, it generally tends to do well in commodity bull markets, and it has at least steadied in the region of the 6 level. Even the South African rand, which has been easy to write off because of the dearth of governance, has rebounded, and it is still steady around this 15 area. So we have the scope that commodity exporters will do better. And that is, of course, assuming that the commodity bull market continues. But it's pretty easy to consider that it will continue because every government in the world wants to fund reflation. And many people are worried about economic scarring as a result of the pandemic. So, as we think about what that means, well, there will be companies that won't open again. There will be stress in terms of various different parts of the economy. The tourist sector might take a little longer to recover than is initially anticipated. Personally, I think that it is more likely than not we're going to have a very significant rebound next year as vaccines, excuse me, this year as vaccines are rolled out. I know my family are gagging for a holiday, but as we think about what the longer term effects are, after the shock of the credit crisis in 2008, people wanted to hold more cash and they were less enthused about highly speculative personal financial decisions. And that desire to hold more cash might have some legs because the kind of speed with which some markets are moving is obviously something that a lot of people are not especially comfortable with, and some people are still expressing a great deal of fear. As we think about what happened over the last few days in the GameStop stock price, one of the people who was saying it was a short received very aggressive threats on social media, and his children were also targeted. So it resulted in the share having to stop trading for a time in here today. Now, it's not like anything really different has occurred in GameStop's business plan, and the share now is above its peak in 2007. There is obviously just this incredible move, which, in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, one would obviously think was a bad tick. But it's an example of the kinds of moves that can happen out of nowhere when you have this roaming mob of people that are trying to spur very short-term gains. Now, this kind of activity, particularly the amplification of the emotional response of people, where one of the defining characteristics of a mania is discrimination, where if you're with the crowd, you're part of the crowd. There's this saying from one of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies that has been really trending on some social media, which is part of the ship, part of the crew. So if you're with us, you're with us. But if you're against us, you're not just against us, but you're our enemy. So that sharply discriminatory attitude is very representative of the mania phase of a bull market. And the other defining characteristic of the mania phase is the tolerance for contradiction. So, is GameStop worth more today than it was in 2007, when the vast majority of games today are bought from downloads rather than going to a store? That you don't need to go to a store to buy any of these types of things. So, why on earth would the share have rallied from 5 to 65 in the space of just 10 months? It doesn't make sense. When we think about other companies, the fact, for example, that Hertz was in bankruptcy and also doubled. Now people are starting to think about AMC Entertainment. Well, the share has pretty much gone nowhere for a year, and it has a market cap today of about 750 million, and its price to sales is 0.1. It's unlikely that it's going to see the same number of people heading back to the cinema in future as it had in the past. We can see that the share had been trending downwards from 2016. It pretty much coincides with the introduction of Netflix. And now we see that HBO and Disney are releasing more of their movies online. So why would one pay the additional premium for going to the cinema when you could enjoy the movie from home? Well, we're starting to see that AMC Entertainment is trending on Reddit. And therefore, it has the potential that it will break on the upside for no good reason, other than the fact that it's a base formation and people are really very, very active in supporting these kinds of moves. Bed Bath & Beyond has just begun to rebound, and it was up 10% in here today. These are the kinds of speculative moves that we see in this mania phase, where people look for stocks not based upon fundamentals, but based upon price, because it's reasonably accessible to buy a share that costs $30. It's not quite the same when a share like Amazon is trading at somewhere in the region of $3,000. But here also, we've seen that Amazon has at least firmed from the region of the trend mean. Well, obviously, we've had these phenomenal bull markets in consumer discretionary type shares. Tesla and Amazon and Uber, they all fall into that discretionary discretionary consumer type of way of thinking about the market. As we then think about what that means in terms of where valuations are overall, well, valuations, if this is similar to the kind of condition that we had in the period up from 1998, well, we had, it was back then, it was the IT sector which was trading on a high valuation. So, when we think about discretionary, then that is Amazon and Tesla. It's trading at a very high price to book, although the price to book is not as high as it was in the 1990s. IT is also trading on a high price to book, but also they have high returns on equity. But consumer staples have an equally high return on equity, but they don't trade at nearly the same price to book. And then materials, industrials, communication, and healthcare, they're all pretty much around where the trend would be based upon that metric of price to book versus return on equity. So if we're thinking about, well, where are the risks? Well, you don't have to look very far. It's certainly in the consumer discretionary and IT sector. If we think about materials, well, that's where we have the greatest evidence of base formation completion. And with commodities universally breaking on the upside and the clear potential that we're in a period of financial repression, well, it's quite likely that we're going to see a commodity-led bull market. But it's not the same kind of commodity-led bull market as we had in the early 2000s. This is not about the introduction of China to the World Trade Organization. This story is much more about the evolution of renewable energy. Just this week, Elon Musk said that he's putting up $100 million for the best solution for carbon capture. When we think about the performance of the solar sector, well, it is doing phenomenally well, and this has been a very clear base formation completion. But it's nowhere near where the valuations were back in 2008. As we think about the hydrogen sector, we had, for example, a Danish company today or this week saying that they were going to redeploy their wind turbines to produce hydrogen for the Danish economy. And the wind sector continues to break out from this very lengthy base formation. Now, the most important thing is that when you see these base formation completions, it's generally consistent with the beginning of a trend, not the end of a trend. When Amazon has been rallying persistently for 20 years, That's not the beginning of a trend. It's more like the end of a trend. So as we then think about, well, where is the bullish potential for the next decade? Well, it's much more likely to be in the sectors where bases have just been completed. So 2020 to 2030 is likely to be the decade of renewable energy, green technology, and electric vehicles. All the companies that are pioneering these types of investments are all breaking on the upside. The commodities that are required to pioneer this evolution are completing base formations and continue to march higher. Lithium, in particular, has been resurgent over the course of the last month. So then we can think about the continued performance of emerging markets, and we can think about that at the confluence of demographics and bond yields. Well, it also, bond yields are representative of the rate of return. So higher bond yields with favorable demographics correspond with higher rates of return overall, and that's harvestable provided currencies are in your favor. So the linchpin for this transition is the dollar. And as long as the dollar is weakening, then it adds fuel to demand for alternatives. But that also means that the dollar is a funding currency for carry trades. And when the dollar rebounds, and every trend has ranges and occasional reversions to the mean, then it will put downward pressure on all forms of speculative investments. And I think that's one of the most important factors, that the dollar is now a funding currency of choice for carry trades. So as we look at the continued performance of the IPO index, and it was at a new high in here today, we can also contrast that, and I think it is important to pay attention to the SPAC index as well, because those are the IPOs of this sector. It continues to march higher. The ARK Innovation ETF has very astutely become the hallmark of this bull market. So it doesn't invest in companies like Amazon. It's all in on companies like Tesla and Roku. And it also continues to march higher. So Cathie Wood has become the biggest bull in this bull market. And everything that she talks about has been breaking out of base formations, not because of any significant big turn in the business model, but rather because these are the kinds of companies that are starting to gain interest from these highly speculative investment ETFs. 3D printing has certainly been the cause célèbre of innovation investors over the course of the last 3 weeks. It's a further example of the fact that investors are being forced to speculate because we're in a negative real interest rate environment. The traditional sector that does well in a negative real interest rate environment is gold, and it has been in a corrective phase since August. But it's also worth reminding ourselves that gold did phenomenally well in the period up from 2018 to the peak in August of 2020. And this doesn't look like anything other than a consolidation in the region of the all-time peak. I think it is quite likely that by the time this gold bull market ends, that what we're going to see is a Dow gold ratio that has compressed meaningfully. One thing that I think is really important here is that the Dow gold ratio was a very reliable cyclical way of looking at markets for a profoundly long time. The cyclicality was in evidence for a century. But we've had a meaningful peak in the ratio, and it did not get all the way back up to the peaks we saw in 1999. So the potential is that it is more like this kind of scenario, like we saw in the period from 74 through to 76, and then we had another low, or this low that we had in the late 1930s. The reality today is that stocks have been outperforming since the low in 2020, but there is the potential that gold will outperform in fits and starts. And unfortunately for investors, that is just the nature of gold. It tends to move in fits and starts. It goes through these lengthy periods of time where it does nothing, and then all of the advance happens in the space of just a few months. And it tends to elicit incredible emotions among investors with an almost schizophrenic way of thinking about the market, that people get incredibly enthused about gold when it is doing well, and they quickly become depressed with gold when it is not the leading asset. But then we can think about how gold is doing in other currencies, because gold does best when it is appreciating in lots of other currencies. And the most important thing is that while the dollar is looking like it will depreciate further, the reality is that gold is likely to do best in the weak currencies. It's certainly firmed this week in Brazilian real. It's also at least holding support in Canadian dollars. When we think about it in euro, then it has been also holding the region of the lows. But one thing that is quite clear is when we look at these charts, that in euro terms, Australian dollars, pounds, it is right in the region of its low. It is below the trend mean. This has been a meaningful pullback. In fact, it's the largest pullback we've seen since the breakout in 2019 in pound terms. So it would certainly be favorable, and it would be a confirmation that we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment for gold, were it to push back above the trend mean in pound terms. Of course, the UK is another one of these markets that has been going sideways for a profoundly long time. And that has been particularly true in US dollar terms, where it really hasn't gone anywhere at all. It also is a testament to how weak the pound has been over the last few years, that it's in the region of the upper side of that range in local currency terms. I continue to think that the UK has an oyster open in front of it, and all it needs to do is deploy the pro-growth strategy in order to outpace the economic potential of most of continental Europe, but it's obviously going to be a difficult task, and not least as economies continue to deal with the ravages of the public response to the pandemic. Then if we think about what the lightning rods are for to monitor as just an indication of where risk resides. Well, this phenomenal advance that we've seen in Bitcoin, for example, well, it has had a significant wobble over the course of the last week, and it briefly pulled back below the $30,000 level. So that, I think, is a significant trend in consistency. One of the defining characteristics of this trend up from the low in March was that each of the ranges was in the region of approximately 20%. This one is over 30%. If Bitcoin doesn't rebound or doesn't hold this rebound, Well, then it's a medium-term peak. Since Bitcoin has benefited from massive flow, it could be then a lead indicator for a period of underperformance by stock markets. We have short-term overbought conditions, and those will eventually be unwound. There are certainly growth potentials, particularly as we come out of this incredibly difficult phase. There is quite likely to be a significant bull market in the renewable energy sector and emerging markets. They're going to be the most promising of sectors as we move into the next decade. But it doesn't mean that they have to go up in a straight line. There are going to be bumps along the way, and buying the dips is likely to be the most profitable exercise as we go forward. So I am particularly monitoring Bitcoin as a barometer for risk, and I'll be selling my Ethereum if it closes below 30,000. I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.